Well, that's Piper and Gunnar.
You a producer or what?
No, I am one talking, unless y'all tell me to get off and shut up.
We're all here. It's a party. Okay. I want to tell you guys a story about it. We were talking about log cabins and we were talking about molasses. And about 10 years ago, my husband and I, we weren't married then, but we got an Airbnb in Yosemite Valley. And it was a guy named Terry. And the only rule was you don't let his dogs out. And he was up at an old logging facility right outside of Yosemite. So about as close as you could get to the park without being in the park. And we showed up. This guy was 6'4", and he was about as rough as they come. And he goes, "Just don't let my dog out." And his dog shows up, and it's a little Yorkshire Terrier in a sweater. And I was like, "Why is this dog out in the woods?" So that was Betsy. We couldn't let her out. And I don't know why that story came up, but that's what I was thinking of when we were talking about.
You did not let him out, did you?
No, we didn't let him out, and he made us dinner. And I was like, this is either the start of a horror story or it's the best Airbnb I've ever had. And I'm still here. So best Airbnb.
Oh, that's awesome.
All right, Piper, am I kicking this off or do you want
to? I can kick it off. I guess I left it hanging there for a second. But
just ran out of things to talk about. I mean, you know, we were talking about the old United States, according to some dude from Carolinas that, you know, I wonder what they know about and terrible barbecue versus great barbecue and the Mid-South and, you know.
The record button makes people nervous once you hit that record button.
It's the same old thing.
It makes me nervous and I've been doing it for a little while now, but.
I guess I'm used to saying stupid things and people hearing it, so it doesn't bother me.
To another episode of Grounded. I am your host, Piper. I'm joined by my co-host, Gunnar, today, and my co-host, Todd, who is part host, part guest. Todd, why don't you introduce our guest today?
Well, you know, we're honored to have my good friend, Jeff Peters, here to talk to us today a little bit, or talk with us today about 45Z and the Inflation Reduction Tax Credit, which really sounds like a super fun topic, but it actually is very important. You know, for farmers and growers across the country. So, Jeff, welcome.
All right. Thanks, Todd. I'm glad to be here and talk a bit more about 45Z. What's the implications going into 2025 for organizations and farmers alike? Like I said, Todd, I've been around for quite a while. I've been in the ag industry for about 30 years. I am based in Central North Carolina, on the road quite a bit. Family has farmed in Northeast Mississippi for multiple generations. So my passion really around the topic of sustainability, regenerative ag and carbon stems from that. I like to make sure that everything is grounded in science and fact and not perception, right? So I think it's important that for producers that we're able to help educate, but also for downstream companies and other organizations, you know, it's sort of a cross-pollination of understanding, because oftentimes, you know, the communication is getting mixed, and it's just good if we have someone that is sort of a Rosetta Stone that can translate for others so they can understand, right?
Well, let's just jump right into it. Jeff, we're really glad to have you today. So tell us a little bit about 45Z. What is it? What's the purpose of it? Why is it here?
Yeah, so 45Z is it's a U.S. federal incentive as part of the Inflation Reduction Act that should go into effect in 2025. It's supposed to go 2025 through 2027. It's going to be available to registered domestic biofuel producers for qualifying transportation fuels, which could mean either aviation or road transportation. And it's really designed to be about production of cleaner fuels. So that means reducing greenhouse gas emissions compared to our traditional fossil fuels today.
Okay. So one of the things that we run into, and I think I've started a lot of things as of late, saying, you know, we got to dispel some of the myths around 45Z, one of which is, it is not a direct payment to the farmer. No. Is that correct? Can you talk a little bit about that and how a farmer can benefit without getting a direct payment?
Yeah. So the payments or the incentives that would come out from this is going to be for those, again, that are registered domestic biofuel producers. That means they have to have created a finished product. It could be ethanol, it could be biodiesel, et cetera, right? The opportunity really for growers is around the potential, I'll say potential, for economic incentive tied to that. And it's based on their feedstock. An example, Todd, might be corn, right? So in corn production, if you're in the Midwest, if they can, they, meaning the farmer, can improve on their nutrient management, if they have adopted cover crops or reduced tillage, all of that will factor into what's a CI score. And if the growers are doing better than the baseline for the CI score, then there's opportunity to receive an incentive. Now, what that incentive is going to look like is yet to be determined. So, again, we're waiting on the guidance to be finalized, which should be the end of the year, early next year.
Yeah, one of the things that, and I said not direct payments to farmers, and I think that there's a little bit of a, to make sure that we've got that couched around. The way the 45Z tax credit has been thrown out by some has been that if a farmer does these practices that are mandated and through the calculations attain a lower CI score, it's been kind of implied that, oh, you're going to make this much per bushel of corn based on this CI score. And I guess from where I sit, I really don't see that as a fact, because it is a tax credit going to the biofuels producer and processor. Instead, what I see is that, you know, farmers have, I loved your word, the opportunity with lower CI scored crops to make a premium by selling into ethanol plants that are participating. And I guess I would couch back. That does not guarantee that X carbon intensity score will get you X amount of dollars. That's up to the processor and the supply of carbon intensity score corn around him and all of that. Is that what you see on this too, Jeff?
Yeah, I think it's really going to be based on the market and supply and demand. I mean, you know, there is the potential for that incentive, but understand that it's a culmination of what the farmer is able to do as well as that processing facility, and they have to be beneath a certain baseline to qualify for that. I think it's a little bit early to set the bar on what a possible incentive would be. You know, right now, some of the indications, especially for, let's say, corn and ethanol, would be 2 cents per CI, 2 cents per gallon per CI point reduction. And again, let's wait and see how the cards fall with the whole thing and understand where the opportunity is going to be. I see this, though, from a grower perspective. If you're a really progressive grower and you're able to reduce relative to that baseline, a huge opportunity out of the gate. If you're maybe a more conventional grower, if you adopt some of these practices, you're going to have an opportunity to play as well. So I think there's going to be opportunities across the board for all farmers that want to participate. I think the key right now, though, Todd, is that the way 40B was structured, and there was a period,
40B being another part of the Inflation Reduction Act.
Yeah, that was really targeted towards aviation, right, and SAF, is that if we can decouple the practices and it doesn't really require growers to adopt a bundle of practices, meaning for corn, it was going to be around, you know, reduction of nitrogen, it was going to be adoption of cover crops, it was going to be reduced tillage, give producers an easier on-ramp to participate, then I think it becomes truly scalable, right? The other thing is that...
Let's pause there for a minute because to make sure everybody understands. So in the Inflation Reduction Act, we've got, you know, different sections. 40B was an early section that actually expires at the end of 2024 that started mandating cleaner fuels. So we had the, you know, focus on SAF there. And as guidance came out about who could participate in this, a farmer had to adopt. I mean, this was a mandatory. You had to do no-till, adopt a cover crop, and have a nitrogen reduction plan, or actually document nitrogen reduction.
And those for corn.
And those were mandatory. If you didn't have all three of those, you couldn't participate. Now, 45Z, which starts as of January 1, and I know.
So it's improvement in water quality, nutrient management, cycling, that sort of thing. So this does have the potential, Todd, of everything I've seen in, I would say, the last 15 years, to be a big win. For the industry as well as the American farmer. And it's really critical, though, that this focuses on domestic production, right? That has to be the case. And I think for this to be a success, it's going to have to strike a balance between the scientific rigor of what we are trying to measure and quantify with commercial utility of implementation with the farmer, right? Farmers are out there farming fields every day. They don't want to farm data. So we have to make the lift and burden a bit lighter for producers to participate in this and to really drive scale, right?
Now, Jeff, you mentioned the protecting the domestic parties, you know, affiliated with this. Is there a chance that foreign parties are going to be involved here and that they're going to be able to take advantage of this tax credit?
I think there's some Gunnar,
you read my mind.
Yeah, I think there's concerns around imports such as used cooking oil that would be coming out of China or tallow that may be coming out of South America. Yes, we need to make sure that the credit is structured in a way that, you know, part of this incentive is going back to the American farmer to encourage crop production, right? And to encourage, you know, continue to do it better. I think about farming in general. It's, man, generation after generation. It's each one is, how do we do it better? How do I do it better than dad? How do I do it better than granddad? And I think now the questions that are being asked of today's producer, it's not just what you produce any longer. It's how you produce it. And then what couples with that that becomes really, really important is the data, because, Todd, that's another component of this that we have to talk about, right? It does require record keeping beyond probably what most growers are doing today, right? So we have to be able to streamline that effort. But growers are building basically a farm pedigree, and that farm pedigree should have value in these future marketplaces, right? The other part of it that we need to talk about is going to be third-party verification, because there's going to have to be evidence to show that indeed these practices have occurred on that particular farm in that particular field. So all of that are sort of the topics right now that the industry is trying to sort out to come up with a way that everyone feels comfortable with a path forward.
Well, there's been a big outline of a plan, and there's a lot of details that still have not been ironed out. I mean, Gunnar, I think that you're exactly right. Jeff mentioned a couple of things. The way that 45Z sits today, the way that this sits today, it is open to not only domestic farmers, but to foreign exports, very specifically. And this is not something I'm in favor of. However, it's happening. We have a company, LanzaJet, that has got a nice ethanol plant down in Georgia, and they're bringing in Brazilian sugarcane for ethanol production there. And, you know, they would be eligible to take advantage of the 45Z tax credit. I disagree with that. I'm not to be too much of a homer, but I believe U.S. tax incentive should be there for, U.S. taxpayers, and that they should be the ones that gain it. Jeff mentioned palm oil, which used cooking oil coming in from China. I honestly didn't know was a thing, but, you know, I think, as we all know, they probably fry more food in China than we do in the South. And that is saying something, because I'll tell you, we fry a lot. But they do have a lot of used cooking oil that can come in with very low CI scores because it has been used. But it also has a potential to be something that, you know, from an environmental perspective is not good, which is palm oil. Which is a very, very detrimental thing. So,
I think the concern is that those products are competing unfairly with U.S. domestication regarding CI scores, right? And we have to make sure that it's a level playing field here, and that also making sure that we're not eroding or devaluing our own American heartland infrastructure that's already been established, right? Really, really important.
Well, I was actually kind of surprised also because Secretary Vilsack recently came out with a comment around these foreign feedstuffs. And, you know, look, I'll say right now, I like Tom Vilsack. I think he has been a really strong Secretary of Agriculture to move the peg in a lot of ways for farmers across the country, especially the last 4 years. And, you know, this is his third term as Secretary of Ag. But he did make a comment that I was surprised at. And and I'm going to paraphrase this, and I'll probably get it partially wrong, that, you know, there is a concern about, you know, effect if we ban foreign feedstocks from the 45Z tax credit, that he's concerned about the effects in on trade. Now, that wasn't anything other than just that one comment, but it did. I was a bit surprised about it. So obviously, he is looking at something that brings him some concern. And while I disagree with that initially, I'll also say, you know, I value the guy's thought process and his position a whole bunch. So, you know, I think there is, it's more than just, hey, we got to have it this way. And there's a lot of different thoughts out there.
Yeah, I think, though, there's a lot of industry, though, rallying behind domestic production right now, Todd. So it's encouraging. You know, I think this has been identified, and I think that, you know, it'll be reviewed, and hopefully everything will go in the right direction here.
What is it that makes the CI score on these foreign imports so much lower? What's the difference in practice? How are they, you know, how are they coming in with a lower CI score than our domestic?
It's not an apples to apples comparison, Piper, in terms of how the accounting goes.
Okay.
So it's a little bit different. And that's what we're saying is, you know, like as we talk about the way the models are structured and everything, I mean, that's a good segue into the GREET model. What are some of the requirements for corn and soybean production that growers going to have to make sure that they can collect the information and be able to, you know, apply that. Yield, of course, is going to be one of those data points that's needed. Your fertilizer rates, your products, that sort of thing will be absolutely required. Did you do any manure applications? Do you apply cover crops? If so, what? Did you do any reduction in tillage? And it could be strip till, it could be no till. There's going to be, you know, several things that'll qualify there. And basically, as you run these models, there's an incremental benefit to some of these practices that have been identified. And again, you're trying to reduce your score and get to zero. So zero would mean carbon neutral. Based on everything that we're seeing right now in a couple of different Midwest geographies, let's say for corn, we are seeing a lot of growers that are probably on the progressive side of conservation are reducing their scores by 10 to 15 points for corn. For soybeans, growers are reducing their scores by probably 2 to 4 points, but both are in the range of, I'm going to say, 30% reduction relative to the baselines that we see right now. Right?
So, Jeff, to play back to Piper's, part of Piper's comments, even given it's not an equal playing field, they're burning fuel to bring that stuff into the United States. How does that not play into adding to CI scoring?
Well, see, that's the thing is that let's call that the indirect contributions are not really being factored in the same way as what we would see on some of the U.S. crop production side, right? So that's what I'm saying. We're not making apples to apples comparison necessarily. Yeah.
What is the baseline CI score for corn or soy? Like, what? Let's de-abstract that number.
Yeah. So right now, if we're looking at feedstock, if we look at, let's say for corn, one of the ones that had been used was 29.1 grams of CO2 equivalents per megajoule of energy. That's output, right? Now that's again for the corn feedstock. the units have changed a little bit as of recently. Now they're being reflected in kilograms of CO2 per million BTU. But again, seeing numbers in the range of, let's say, 12 to 20 is not uncommon right now. What we're seeing is sort of distributions that reflect growers that are on different scales of adoption of practices, which you would expect. And, you know, the higher curves are more reflective of, well, they've integrated one practice into their operation. And then as you go down further on that scale, you can see the maybe 5 to 10% of growers or acres have probably adopted two or more of those practices, right? But there's opportunity for every grower to participate in the program. That's the great thing. It's not just saying that it's only going to be the progressive farmers. The conventional farmers could participate as well.
It sounds like, too, for progressive farmers who have already made these changes, you know, sometimes I think on the carbon side, on the offset side, we see like, oh, you've already made the changes. You've already improved this much. Maybe it's too late to get in the game because you've been doing this for 15 years versus a farmer, grower, ranch who's conventional and they're now changing back. So this seems like, yeah, you're going to be rewarded for this work you've already maybe been doing for a decade or plus. Is that true?
Yeah, Piper, that's the great part of this. And so if you're a conventional farmer, we want to have programs out there that fit your operation. If you're a progressive grower, to your point, a lot of the carbon programs for food and feed, you know, those growers haven't been able to really play in those markets yet. So this is a huge benefit to everyone. And it really, at the end of the day, guys, yes, while we're focused on decarbonization and developing cleaner transportation fuels, the bigger impact here could be resiliency on the farm for the longer term and the adoption of these conservation practices, which we know, again, I'm going to say it, Todd, is that they have benefits far greater than just sequestering carbon or reducing carbon, right?
Yeah, but I think one of the challenges comes into as well, Jeff, and I guess this is a little bit about where, you know, I'll take off a corporate hat, put a personal hat on and say, I agree with what you're saying, but, you know, to where Piper is also going, you've got a portion of farmers that have been out there with no-till, which is very positive. And then you have the vast majority of farmers out there that are in conventional tillage and may have some reduced tillage. I know that one of the very large points of pride for me at Earth Optics is that we introduced the first of a kind tillage prescription. What I'm concerned about in these programs is the following. We reward things that have been done. We don't absolutely help move the peg. And when I look at 40B and mandated practices like no-till, I mean, look, nationally, we've got 20 to 30% of the farmers out there in a no-till program in row crops. It's probably not going to 40. So the question becomes, how do we remove mandated practices, put in a host of practices, and actually pay farmers for an outcome? Because the reality is we should be spending the money that, like this in 45C, that brings about a change, that helps move the peg overall on real CI scoring, not just worries about a mandated practice. And I know, you know, that's a couple of things that I know in the GREET model. Yeah, there are things that, you know, it accounts for, but let's face it, there's a whole host of things that it does not. And so, you know, it's a step forward, but how do we get this to something that we can ensure makes real change?
Yeah, I would say this, Todd. I think it's imperative, though, first generation or first iteration of this, we need to adhere to the KISS model, right? Keep it simple. And
it's another, you know, Jeff, by the way.
Yeah, but we'll keep that for another time, right? I didn't want to insult you, Todd. So
that's all right. I've never believed in the KISS model, man. I'm thinking go as complex as possible.
Go big or go home. Yeah,
big or go home, man. Yeah, that's another
Southern thing. we have to make sure that we don't over-design something, right? And that it's something that a grower can actually integrate in their operation. And on top of that, it's really, really important. We haven't mentioned this yet, is to understand what are the trade-offs to adoption of these practices, to yield, to quality, you know, to the overall bottom line for the farmer, right? That's the first question a grower is going to ask, right? What does it mean to my bottom line? So we have to make sure that these solutions actually are beneficial, and that we can go out with confidence and say, we want to support you in adoption of these practices on farm, and that we have local agronomists that are going to help those producers make that transition, right? So technology, innovation, solutions.
I got to ask you a question about this then. I mean, really, this one's been driving me nuts. I grew up on a dairy farm. For years, I shoveled a massive amount of cow manure. I even had a skid loader to help me do it. I mean, we were manure people. As I look at our leading farms today, absolutely know there are some very progressive and innovative farmers out there that farm, you know, cattle, farm hogs, farm corn, soybeans, all this, that utilize manure assets as fertilizer. Mm-hmm. Do we have any idea how many people that is? Because I think that as a percentage of farms as a total, it's really small, and yet
it is.
We're spending a lot of time talking about manure.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree. It is a small subset of growers that we've seen as well in our pilots. And, you know, it's all about availability, location, where you're at, right? And I've worked in areas in the past. It could be chicken litter, you know, turkey litter, the whole nine yards. There's absolutely benefits to that. You know, with synthetics, I just want to make sure, though, what we're talking about at the end of the day, guys, is really optimizing the use of our inputs, right? It's optimization. It's not taking a tool away from the grower. And it's really, really important, Todd, that we convey that, right, is that we're not trying to take tools out of the toolbox. We're trying to add tools in that fit a particular situation. And it is fundamental to farming to know this, is that we are not suggesting cut, copy, paste to agriculture, because every grower, every farm, every field could be a different situation. To even integrate into the models yet to consider them. So I would say that some of these other technologies are probably for a subsequent phase. Once we have enough data that we can go out confidently with a grower and say, yeah, we can, you know, get behind this, right? We know it's going to have a positive benefit.
Like, take care of these opportunities. I mean, you're among the best of companies that have been out there. So that's really good.
Yeah.
I didn't have to diverge. I got to diverge for a minute. Got to diverge. Man, look, you know, growing up on a dairy farm and knowing about manure, you know certain things. And I have to tell a story, because I always have a story, because you mentioned chicken litter. And that's I'm in Arkansas. There's a lot of chickens, which means there's a lot of chicken litter. We got, you know, Ross Perot famously said in 1992, we're a big chicken state. So got to tell you, Marty and I moved to Fayetteville about 8 years ago. And, you know, we moved into a new house and the yard kind of looked crappy. And I hired a guy to come over here, and he said, yeah, you know, the soil's not real good, because we live on a mountain. It's mostly rock. And he said, soil's not real good here. You know, you need some organic mix on this soil. Yeah, that sounds good. Let's do that. How much you think I need? Oh, about 15 tons. I can get that up here and get it spread all over your yard. I said, I'm on board. And I was driving up the mountain from the office the day he was putting the organic mix down, and realized I was an idiot, because as I drove up the mountain, all I could smell was freaking chicken litter. And what he had put down was an organic mix of chicken litter and a little bit of dirt. My neighbors camped out in front of my house with a bonfire and pitchforks for 3 freaking weeks. We had just moved in, and I mean, people were, you know, running by the house in the morning. I'd say, hey, how you doing? And they'd flip me off. It was a bad way to start, you know, a new neighborhood. So that's, you know, I've had a lot of manure experiences, if you can think of another word I might put there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, again, it comes back to the trade-offs. Everything, you need to make sure what the pros and cons are going
to
be.
You need to make sure what's going on, and you definitely need to know the definitions around and what the application.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of expectations on programs and even some of the programs that we're talking about right now, that they're going to be 100% right out of the gate. It takes time, right? And I think the program will evolve. I think it will improve. I have to applaud USDA, DOE, and the Treasury Department, because it is a step in the right direction, right? It's just everyone needs to provide feedback to their industry coalitions that can really rally behind this at the end of the day.
Jeff, can you explain a little bit more in practice how it looks from the standpoint of, let's say, for instance, we have a grower who's been running just standard conventional practices, you know, maybe just deep ripping his fields each year, no cover crops, no nothing. How does it look like for a grower to actually make a transition and start employing some of these conservation practices? And what sort of incentives are there for growers to help them on the front end and deal with the overhead that oftentimes comes with these practices?
Yeah, I think first is education, right? Here's my advice is that for all growers right now, if you're interested in CI scoring, at least at minimum, understand what your CI score is and what the possibility is going to be. Number two, understand what practices are going to give you the biggest bang for the buck, right? Because you may be making some capital investment. If you're making a tillage change, you may say, well, my break even is going to be 5-7 years. That, you know, it may not be that I want to go pursue that out of the gate, but you may have growers that are ready to make that transition. And it's like, okay, that's just a cherry on top. You know, it makes sense for me to do that. You know, cover crops tends to be the biggest bang for the buck in investment. And it's, again, I'm going to come back to it's working with your local agronomist and others that can give you the right information, right, to help support you on that transition and to reduce that risk and that barrier to adoption out of the gate. And then we're going to develop establishment guidelines that we'll provide back to the farmers, you know, from our learnings, right? So I think it's really, really important is to kind of walk together on that journey because, you know, Gunner, this is a journey of common understanding. Now, there's a lot of information that's been out there for years, but we just want to make sure, like, with, especially with a cover crop, the first question a grower should be asking around a cover crop, you know, is, does it fit my needs, right? Am I trying to scavenge nitrogen? Am I trying to build nitrogen? Am I trying to use it for grazing? What am I trying to reduce compaction, Todd? So all those things are really, really important. So ask questions, learn. The market, though, is not set yet. So I think you just need to be, as a grower, in a position to play in the market if it takes off. I just be cautious on investing too much too soon in the marketplace until we get further guidance. You know, the way we look at some of this, too, Gunnar, I'm going to go a little bit different direction here, is with the modeling piece of this. We don't want to over-design, over-engineer a model that we feel like, okay, it's going to be perfect. We can't let, you know, perfect be the enemy of the good out of the gate on this. And that if we could pre-process a lot of this and it becomes a simple drop-down for a grower to say, okay, practice A, B, and C, and then we're doing the verification steps that are required, that reduces the burden of entry, and it makes it so much easier for growers to participate, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know, that's kind of where I'm at.
I've really noticed for all of these, you know, outside of 45Z, all of these different sustainability programs, you know, I think one point that we touched on for the first 10 or 15 minutes is, you know, these were stood up to empower the producers here, the domestic growers here. And so it's always important to keep that in mind, and that always needs to be priority number one. And then second of all, it's like you just said, reducing those barriers to entry. A lot of these programs can be super confusing, and it can sound, and oftentimes it is, an incredible amount of work for a grower themselves to get involved with one of these. And that's on top of, you know, changing the practices that they're employing on their operation and whatnot. And so making it as seamless as possible for growers to take advantage of these opportunities and having the built-in flexibility for anybody and everybody to mold it into their operation is really critical for the success here.
Yeah.
I have a question about that. Sorry, Jeff. Grower, and I want to calculate my CI score if I want to know that. That was the first thing you mentioned. How do I do that? How do I go about getting that information?
Well, there's going to be a lot of different organizations out there that have tools. And actually, the Argonne National Laboratory has a download version of GREET. It's an older version that you could do your own self-assessment. There are a number of free online assessments that you can do as well. there are, I would say, at least 10 different organizations right now that are characterizing farms and fields with growers to understand what they look like. Mm-hmm. Some are free, some are charging, some are offering, you know, incentive to growers just to go through the exercise. Again, just make sure that it's a credible source that you're using. Make sure it is the GREET model. It may not be the most current version, so understand that whatever the score is you get today may change based on the guidance that comes out in 2024. I wouldn't expect it to change radically, but it's a possibility. Now, understand 40B, the way it was developed was it was just assigning 10 points to corn, let's say, for example, if you did those three practices that Todd reflected earlier. I think it was very, very conservative approach. But I do believe that we need to give full credit to farmers for what they're doing, and that those three practices, if you run the GREET model right now, would be far greater than 10 points, right, in reduction. So I think we need to make sure that there is enough rigor to it that growers are getting credit for everything they're doing.
Now, Jeff, can you explain a little bit more? So you can start making claims starting January 1 of this upcoming year, and then 45Z sunsets at the end of 2027, I believe. Can you explain why that is and what kind of the thought process is there? My understanding is it's to really catalyze change by putting it within kind of a more restricted window of time, and then perhaps then there's more options to make amendments to it for future iterations. Am I capturing that correctly, or how does that work?
40B is designed to sunset at the end of the year, and then 45Z was going to pick up from there. But the guidance, we'll see. You know, expectation would be early January this coming year that would be rolled out. There's no certainty to that. I think we're all kind of waiting. There's also some discussion going on at the moment that would extend that window beyond the three-year period. So if you look out there right now, there are some congressional support to go way beyond just the three-year window, right? The thing about it, I think it's critical for farmers and for the industry alike. We have to have enough lead time to react to this, right? So if the window is so narrow, it's going to be really hard to integrate it into our systems in the timeline that we're talking about. And I would say whether you're a farmer or whether you're a processor or anyone else in the supply chain, at a minimum, you need 6 to 9 months lead time with clear guidance on what it's going to be, right? So otherwise, it puts everyone in a reactionary mode, you know, to try to integrate it. And I would say the likelihood, if it comes out in 2025, is that it'll start slow. And then as we go into 2026, 2027, I can see quite a bit of a expansion of that pretty quickly, right?
So one of the things, just to throw this in too, you know, there's a lot of, Jeff mentioned congressional discussions going on. So we talked earlier about the issue around foreign feedstocks, and, you know, there are 42 senators that have gone on record and sent a letter to Secretary Yellen, you know, emphasizing the need to have domestic producers and domestic ag producers, you know, exclusively in this segment. So that's one aspect. But, you know, Earth Optics is part of the Sustainable Aviation Fuel Coalition, the SAF coalition, that has gotten started out over the last couple of years. And honestly, I don't even know how many corporate members there are, but I can tell you on each call we have, there's about 100 different companies represented, with airlines, you know, leading the way. So representatives from every airline out there. One of the pushes that the SAF coalition is doing right out of the gate is pushing to extend 45Z for another 3 years. So have it really run through the end of the decade. Now, whether they can accomplish that or not, as Jeff said, there's a lot of discussion right now going on in Capitol Hill for, you know, some of the political issues that come around between, you know, Republicans and Democrats with regards to climate smart activities and, you know, the value and how they should be paid for. Sustainable aviation fuel is actually a pretty popular topic on both sides of the aisle. So from that perspective, I do think that, you know, that's, I think there's a really good opportunity. It'll be extended. As Jeff said, look, it's going to start slow. I mean, there are companies that have processors in 2025 that are going to start tracking this, but not really be in a position to start taking advantage of the tax credit, thereby buying farmers low CI score crops at a premium until 2026. Well, then you've got 2 years left. So it's barely any time to really get started and, you know, see an effect. So I think there's a good opportunity it'll get extended, at least in the current political environment and where everybody's thinking. But it is going that since it is, you know, codified by law in Congress, it will have to have a congressional change to extend it.
Yeah, and right now that proposal is out there. You know, it came out about 2 weeks ago from representatives, U.S. representatives from Kansas and Ohio. And Todd, they're proposing to extend it to 2034, right?
Yeah, which is even better.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, really encouraging. But we have to make sure that we've got enough runway to be able to integrate it, you know, into our supply chains.
Agreed. So there was two questions I wanted to ask you. One, I'm going to put you on the spot with, which I know you love that. There's a lot of talk about cover crops as part of this program. Cover crops are always in the program. Now, look, cover crops have benefits. 100% know that. 100% agree with that statement. But cover crops are tricky economically for a farmer. So many of the programs subsidize cover crops, Jeff, because cover crops are expensive to put in, and even though they do good economically, they don't make the sense on everybody's farm, and trying to push that economic sense is pretty hard. When do we get to a point that we're not trying to push so much of an incentive on cover crops, and instead we get to a point where we have developed a cover crop system that can actually be economically feasible in different situations?
Yeah. You know, for grazing, it makes absolute sense, right? I mean, there's definitely an ROI to that. And for some other areas, it may or may not be. I look at these, Todd, like these programs, you know, it's a transition point where the government is trying to subsidize and catalyze a movement in the right direction, which I think the intention is perfect. But there's a second bridge that we have to cross, and the private markets are going to have to step up as well and incur some of this to help facilitate this with growers. You know, the other part of this, we can talk about non-cash cover crops, but we need to think about, what about cash winter crops, right?
You're speaking my language, man. I happen to be a huge fan of camelina. If that raspberry proves out, that may answer a lot of problems.
Well, that gets back to what you're asking is, you know, how can a grower actually make a living out of a winter cover crop, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's potential there. But those are, you know, it's going to take time to scale those. And I know a number of organizations are investing time and effort in research, but we got to make sure the genetics are going to be right. We've got to make sure that we can scale it to its real potential. So a processing facility would take that on. We have to give growers confidence that, yes, that processor is going to be there year on year on year. They're going to integrate it into their system. And mainly, we got to make sure we understand the agronomic production of that crop so we can educate growers on what it takes, right? Because for a lot of growers, these, let's say, winter oilseed crops, they're different. They're entirely different, right? Different beast.
Well, it's interesting when we, you know, just a quick commercial on camelina. So Earthopix is working with, a couple of different firms with camelina, but notably Global Clean Energy Holdings. And son of a gun, you know, been very impressed that in the north, you know, you talk about into the Montana area, it's a summer crop. You move down into the southern part of the United States, and it is a winter cover crop. And, you know, I've seen some of the processing capacity of taking camelina into diesel, and it's, wow, shocking, very clean, very, high over. So I agree with you. Although I do have to tell you, you said biodiesel several times. The camelina guys have, you know, slapped me around enough to tell me The correct term is now renewable diesel, not biodiesel, renewable diesel.
Yeah, that's a drop in. Yeah. So I would say on that is the key, though, you know, with these winter cover crops is they factor right into this conversation here around 45Z and lower CIs, right? Their potential is really, really great. If we can scale them, the key is if we can scale them, if we can get the right genetics for the right region, and it's finding the Goldilocks zone.
And it's really, I mean, it's in development. I mean, I think ideally from my standpoint, it'd be great to find that, see them succeed or find something very similar that could do that. Jeff, got to ask you about one thing we haven't really talked about, and it's in the GREET model, but it's not very good in the GREET model, but it's talked about a lot in different aspects. And I want to make sure everybody understands what it is. And that's ILUC, indirect land.
Yeah.
So can you give us a little bit on that and what you think the effects are, positive, negatives on, you know, a grower's program?
Yeah. So the indirect land use change is a topic that's a lot of debate, and it's how potential increase in let's say feedstock for biofuels may impact or, you know, food, right, or food security. And there's estimates on what those numbers would be, you know, in terms of displacing crop A to crop B. Some of those numbers, I would say, are pretty aggressive based on the assumptions, and they may overestimate what that value could be. There's others out there that are more conservative. So the California models tend to be a bit more aggressive on that estimate, but it's absolutely something that's going to have to be factored into the equation, because as this part takes off, we need to make sure that we're creating and striking a balance here on the whole thing. And I would say that a lot of the conservation groups right now are bringing this up as a hot topic. As we get into like the Northern Plains and other areas where you have grasslands, you may see, you know, changes there in some of the efforts that will be underway. So Todd, it's one of those that to be determined on where this falls. I would say 40B made a step in the right direction. The values did improve to some degree. I think the models can still be optimized a bit, but we need the right data to help calibrate those. You know what I mean? Time will tell where this will play out, but it is a very touchy topic.
Yeah. Okay. So to play that back on, you know, to fit kind of the simple method here, it is really affecting if I'm planting a crop that is going into a fuel area, and it is sacrificing me planting a crop that goes into a food area. That would be a negative impact on carbon scoring, according to ILUC, indirect land use change.
That's exactly right, because it has to be picked up somewhere else in the world, right?
Right.
And so it's accounted
by negative scoring, not lowering my carbon score. In that instance, it would actually raise it. So you can see real quick how it's a hot topic in those situations.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Hey, Todd or Piper, I do have to jump in like 2 minutes or 3 minutes, if that's okay.
I think that's probably a pretty good place for us to round it up.
That's okay. Good.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Jeff, it was really great to have you here today. I think we covered a lot of great topics covering 45Z and the previous 40B tax credit. Do you have any last closing words for us? And then we can wrap up.
No, Todd, thanks for the invitation to join you guys today. It's, again, I think it's a promising area. We'll find out in the next 6 months how this takes shape, and look forward to how it can scale in the future. But thanks for the time today, and look forward to working with you guys in the future.
And Jeff, thank you for being here. Piper, Gunnar, thank you for letting me crash your party. Enjoyed it today.
Of course. Yeah, maybe we'll have a part two in a year or two, and we'll catch up and see how everything's played out. But in the meantime, thanks again, Jeff. Catch us on every social media platform, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Give us a like, follow, share with your friends, family, neighbors, and stay grounded.
Awesome.